You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 30th,
2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of Brooklyn, USA.
In the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA.
I knew I forgot something.
You stepped on my lines and you messed it up, but it's okay. I love you. On today's program, Milton Alamadi. He's the publisher of Black Star News. We're talking about President Obama's visit to Africa, to Kenya and Ethiopia, to be specific. The opportunities in that continent for transformation, economic growth, and the broader security picture there. It's going to be a good conversation. I'm a big fan of Milton, and we didn't touch on that story too much while it was happening, so it's good to have a wrap-up of it. Plus, someone had the brilliant and compassionate and amazing and awesome idea to record a focus group of Donald Trump supporters. And some of it is really as good as it sounds. The great thing about Donald Trump is that he never disappoints. Him and all of his people around him are, well, they're awesome. They generate relentlessly hilarious content. Turkey says it's making moves against IS, but really they're making moves against the Kurds. And it's strategically, morally obscene. We're going to get to that. What else we got, Matt? Also, yeah, go ahead.
We got tons of stories today. Tons. Some in the better half, some not in the better half.
Indeed.
That's all I'm going to say.
That's all. Ooh.
No.
Very cryptic.
Imagine.
Very cryptic tease.
No, we have, in all honesty, we have that horrific, we're going to talk about that horrific video that came out yesterday of a unarmed black man being shot and killed by a police officer at a traffic stop. It's horrendous. And another story about the fallout of another black man who was beaten by police, and we'll give you an update on that story as well.
A lot to get to. I mean, that story is so obscene that there's actually been a murder charge. It was so blatant. Obviously, we think there should be a lot more murder charges in these cases, but fortunately, there's one in that one. Obviously, also your calls and IMs plus. Bernie Sanders had a great events across the country, which we'll get to. But before we get to that, I need to tell you something about today's sponsor. And today's sponsor is ZipRecruiter. And I'm assuming that if you're listening to this show, that you're probably a person of discernment. You're probably an employer who wants talented, great people. And you're probably someone who, unlike others, appreciates talented and great people. So I want to point you to ZipRecruiter. So basically, did you know this summer, and summer in general is the best time to hire the best people because the competition's on vacation. So quality candidates are there for you with less competition for them. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. Short staffing leaves little time to post on dozens of job sites. So basically, you can post up to 100 plus jobs with a single click, watch brand new candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface within 24 hours, plus be instantly matched with candidates from over 4 million resumes. Your needs are going to get met. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses. And today you can use it for free. You go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And sign up today, and you will have your needs met by this amazing website. I'm just going to really quick, I'll read you one testimony. This is from Lisa Palm. This is from November 2014. As a recruiter, getting your ad in front of as many candidates as possible in a cost-effective manner is key. ZipRecruiter will do that. Customer service is great. And you will often offer tips. Assistance is always just a phone call or a few keystrokes away should you ever need it. That's key. Think of how many newfangled web businesses have horrible customer service. Not ZipRecruiter. Get great candidates in an easy way. Sign up today. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. It's also on our website.
And Sam should keep this website in mind, especially for when Matt and Mike have a bigger show than the Majority Report.
Bye-bye.
And he needs to look for a job, and he wants to get hired by us.
We will definitely give his resume a serious read. Okay, folks, we're going to take a brief break and come back with Milton Alamadi on the Majority Report.
Yeah. Can't kill me again if you never kill me already. Yes, I. And we say, Jehovah, life over death, demon can't kill me again. We say, good over evil, life over death, Satan can't kill me. Here comes the hot staper, fire burning hotter than paper. That song you written proper than later. Protected from the crown of my head, straight down to the very soul of the crepe, yeah. Me have a chat for them, them send gunshot poisons, yeah, accident. Long time, them a try like half my oxygen. But you're in control, can't take me soul. Over evil, life over death, demon can't kill me again. Me say, good over evil. Life over death, demon can't kill me, Them put poison in a liquor, try curse me. A good thing, me no drink, me no thirsty. From the day my mother birthed me, still I see I hurt me, nobody can hurt me. Them disguise Decibel in a the biggest way. Send her come to give me the biggest aid. Can it clap her in dismay?
We are back on the Majority Report.
My name is Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Milton Alamadi. He is the publisher of Black Star News and really a noted and widely sought-after commentator on African affairs and a friend. Milton, great to have you on. How are you?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on your show again. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's always a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So you had a really broad and interesting perspective, as you are wont to do, on President Obama's trip to the African continent, to Ghana and Ethiopia specifically. Let's start by going sort of from the big picture, and we'll move towards the granular. You basically said that, you know, rhetorically, President Obama seems like he understands the moment that the continent is in terms of economic opportunity, in terms of political opportunity, in terms of a sort of incredible talented youth bulge. So explain what rhetorically President Obama got right on this trip and the specific moment we're in Africa in the context for his visit.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that question. Rhetorically, he knows that Africa has the youngest population on average, the youth population. So he speaks to that, and that's really interesting because when the Chinese leader goes there, for example, and you know there's a huge contest between China and the U.S.,
yeah.
for Africa's resources. The Chinese president would never speak straight to the African youth, and no U.S. president has ever done that. So the president was very perceptive in seeing that as an opening. And in terms of where Africa is in its history, he was conscious of that when he went in 2009, and he knew exactly what to say in terms of what people need to hear. But listen, this is a continent of abundant resources. Congo alone, the estimated mineral wealth is $30 trillion.
Wow.
So
could you repeat that again? $30 trillion?
$30 trillion. That's okay. One country alone, the Congo. The Congo pretty much has everything that the continent needs. So why is it that in the midst of such abundance, we have so much poverty, lack of development, and so forth? It's because of entrenched bad leadership. It would be different if you had a leader in an African country who's there for 30 years and he's doing something like Lee Kuan Yew did in Singapore.
Right.
That's different. You could always, you know, denounce him and still say, hey, listen, you've been there too long. Get out of the way. But when you've been there too long and you're presiding over a economic retrogression and degradation, then obviously people want you out of the way as soon as possible. So he addressed that issue beginning in 2009, the need for Africa leaders who stay there too long to really step aside and allow a newer generation to flourish and the Africa to realize its potential. So that's the good speak. But then when you find the rhetoric is not matched up with the reality, when you find that the U.S. is actually the principal supporter of some of these long-term dictators. As you know, the U.S. had a long history with Mobutu in what was then Zaire and now Congo. And then the U.S. still has that tradition with respect to Kagame in Rwanda and Yoweri Museveni in Uganda. So therein lies the contradiction. He knows what to say, but when it comes to practice, it's been really hard to shift the U.S. away from the traditional history of dealing with Africa in an imperialistic way.
Yeah, that's.
I don't know if that wraps it up in a way.
No, that wraps it up really helpfully. I want to go just briefly to one positive step that President Obama has made that you've highlighted in terms of developing youth leaders in Africa. Actually, as a matter of fact, we'll get, because I really want to tease out the bigger picture here and the contradiction, but briefly, explain to us this tangible step that President Obama has made on cultivating youth leadership in Africa.
Okay, very good. Well, he started the Mandela Fellows Fellowship for African Youth Leadership last year, and that brings in about 500 young leaders from African countries involved in activism, involved in entrepreneurship, people that are launching their own businesses, for example, and people that are just academically talented and really bright. So they're brought here, and then they are taken to several U.S. universities just to interact with the other scholars here and be trained. And then they go back to their countries. And I think that's very critical because they then become leaders within the countries, and then they have an important network that they develop when they're brought to this country, so they can really spark have a multiplier effect in their specific countries. And then one other thing that people aren't aware of is that Africa is becoming increasingly very wired in terms of the internet and cell phones, and young people are very adept at using that to start their businesses. So whereas the older generation were kind of locked up, if you're not in with the leadership and you don't have access to capital, you can't do anything except wait for somebody in government to give you a job. The younger folks in Africa have a different opportunity. Because once you can set up online or on your mobile device, you can tap into capital from funding sources all over the world. And the president realizes that. So in a way, he's bypassing the older folks in Africa and dealing directly with the youth. When he was in Kenya and he spoke to an audience in Kenya, he acknowledged by name many of the young Kenyan entrepreneurs who had actually launched successful businesses online. And that's very, and beyond that, he's also actually, I think, openly encouraging the youth to take action in terms of leadership. I think because of his, I won't say directly, but I think because of his influence, I think it probably played a role in Burkina Faso last year when Blaise Compaoré, who had already been there for 27 years, tried to tinker with the constitution and take out term limits so he can run again. As you recall, the young folks just came out on the streets using social media to mobilize, and they drove him out of the country. And as a result, Burkina Faso is going to have its first open election ever. And many young people are also contesting in this election, and that's going to be in October this year. And that's why the young generation is actually going to be very critical in transforming Africa.
Yeah, and there's also an interesting historical symmetry because, of course, President Obama's father came to the United States and, you know, was able to acquire an education here and take it back to Kenya. So that's
Very, very I'm glad you brought that up. So he relates to that. And also, as you know, he is very adept in communicating with young folks. And that's why he won the youth vote in the 2008 election. I think he won 66%. Mm-hmm. And in 2012, he won about, I think, 60% of
which was amazing because Mitt Romney was great at communicating with youth.
Absolutely. And
I couldn't resist. He's not even around anymore. I'm still taking shots at him.
You caught me for a whole half second. but Michael,
yes.
I think what he's done is he's actually unleashed a force on the continent that the older leaders, whether they like it or not, are no longer going to be able to contain.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, nobody is going to be able to tolerate working with you if the youth decide to rise up in African countries and you start shooting them down. That's not just going to happen. So even though for strategic purposes, the U.S. might work with the president of Rwanda, Kagame, and Uganda, Museveni, if the young people in those countries want to drive them out and they start shooting back at those folks, there's no way that the U.S., under any circumstances, would be able to still continue siding with them. So I think that's why I see a great opening happening in Africa. And just by judging by the way young folks are reacting to his embracing the youth on social media.
So let's get then to the contradictions and the problems. And I think I want to tease this out a little bit. You've written really, really well about this because it seems like and I think it's also very interesting in the context of questioning even the positive agenda that President Obama has for Africa and the positive rhetoric, because when we look at, you know, bad situations in Africa in terms of human rights or in terms of dictators or autocrats or whatever, you know, we have to make a couple of distinctions right out of the gate. So there's some, a guy like Mugabe, who obviously does not have a good relationship with the United States or the West,
right,
does have a terrible human rights record and kind of represents just the sort of souring of an anti-colonial legacy, I guess, for lack of a better way of phrasing it. And there is a certain contingent that he represents. Then, as you keep pointing out, there's people like Museveni in Uganda who,
right,
you know, people are aware of him, I think, because of the vicious attacks in the gay community, which are horrific. But the truth is that he is just, on a grand scale, a massive human rights violator across the board. He uses the military really as almost a private militia. But he is quite close to the United States. He's on the neoliberal sort of economic agenda. He's certainly co-signing with the U.S. In terms of security strategy in Africa, which is another major question and component of what's happening there, and obviously going to play out in terms of terrorism and in terms of the resource competition with China. And then just also you've raised this. I just want to put this on the table, too, to sort of disaggregate. When you go to South Africa, which obviously has this incredibly noble, you know, history that people have a sense of, if it's even just through Nelson Mandela. But the truth is that the African National Congress has, and really I think at this point we could say very clearly under Jacob Zuma, is really sliding. It's not delivered on serious poverty reduction. It's quite corrupt in many respects, and it embraced an austerity and neoliberal agenda quite early on, I think for very understandable reasons historically. But again, those policies, you know, there's nothing special about Greece, right? They don't deliver.
Right.
And so I guess what I'm trying to get to is that could some of those youth movements, first of all, talk about those three kind of general areas, and could those youth movements, you know, sometimes be aligned with the U.S. against the dictator and an autocrat and for cleaner governance, possibly, but also be opposed to the U.S. because they're opposing neoliberal policies that the U.S. is generally going to push for in the continent and globally?
Okay. And I'm going to touch on all the issues that you brought up. But I want to start off at the tail end, first of all.
Yeah.
In terms of the youth, I think if there's any alliance with the U.S., it's simply because they, in countries where the leadership has been so horrendous, their number one goal is to be just to be able to get rid of those leaders. And they're aware, of course, of the contradictions and the U.S. hypocrisy as well.
Right.
I think if the president of China, Xi, had made that approach and come and said, listen, the youth have always been critical in China, and we want the youth to take leadership in African countries as well. And if they could see that, they could get rid of long-term dictators by aligning with China, they would do that as well.
Right.
So I think basically they're looking for the best way to get rid of the lid, get rid of the system that's entrenched and holding back their potential, because they know what is available to young people all over the world just by social media engagement. So that's how I would approach the tail end of that.
Mm-hmm.
They also, at the same time, know the power and the influence of the U.S. and how the U.S. Basically dominates the global finance with institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. So they know that, okay, as we partner with the U.S. to get rid of these leaders, it's not going to be easy to have a total dependent policy afterwards. They know the U.S. sort of a grip or hold on them as well.
Right.
But then in terms of touching on some of the contradictions you mentioned earlier, yes, and I'm glad you laid it that way, Mugabe versus Museveni, for example. So, even with all the human rights abuses that's been documented and reported in Zimbabwe, it totally pales compared to what Museveni and Kagame have done.
Right.
They should not even be mentioned in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, if you say that to people, most people won't believe you, because people like Museveni and Kagame, not only are they protected by the U.S. Government and the British government, because as you say, they've embraced neo or orthodox economics, and once you embrace that, you say the World Bank is fine and the IMF is fine, you can do anything and get away with it. As we saw, and it's not only Africa, we saw that in Chile as well,
with
Pinochet.
Right.
So that's how I would give a comparison, would be like a Pinochet. So, for example, how many people are aware that it's because of the invasions of their armies, the invasion of Congo by Rwanda and Uganda, that as many as 6 million Congolese have actually died? I mean, if Mugabe had been involved in something like that, I think he would definitely be in The Hague by now.
Right.
He would have been. They would have found a way to extricate him from Zimbabwe and take him for trial, and he would have been locked up already. But we don't get that. As you pointed out, Museveni and Kagame are seen as allies of the U.S. In fact, when the president was in Addis Ababa, he met with the Kenyan president, and he met with the Ethiopian prime minister, and he met with Museveni as well.
Right.
So you would ask yourself, and yet Mugabe is supposed to be the pariah. He's supposed to be the one that should not ever be seen in the same room with a U.S. president, for example. So the contradiction and hypocrisy, it's just astounding. And that's why you find that a person like Mugabe actually has a lot of popular support in Africa. And also progressive elements around the world also really support him because they can see the contradiction and hypocrisy in the U.S. policy.
Right. I mean,
and
I certainly.
The ANC.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying I certainly.
I was going to wrap up. I was going to say the ANC.
Yeah, please.
And you're right about the ANC. The ANC has really, really discredited the legacy of Nelson Mandela in terms of what it has become now. Basically, the top leadership is now competing on who gets to become the richest.
Right.
So you have a bunch of, I'm not talking millionaires, I'm talking multi-millionaires, where some of them, the leadership, have now made deals with the major mining companies and the major corporations that have earned them literally hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm sure there are a handful who are probably billionaires by now. I think Cyril Ramaphosa, for example, is, you know, I believe a billionaire.
He was, I think he's definitely a billionaire.
Estimated at $750 million about 3 years ago. So that's really a sad contradiction. But you also pointed out, will the youth have a say on this? And I think in South Africa, it's already happening. And that's why you see that party by Julius Malema.
Mm-hmm.
I think that party is going to grow increasingly in South Africa. And I think perhaps not in the next election cycle, but in two election cycles by now, I can actually see the ANC eventually losing.
That would be pretty stunning. And I just want to say, because I actually this opens up another point that I think is important to touch on before we wrap up our conversation. But I mean, I certainly don't support or really have any sympathy for Mugabe. I think his human rights violations are atrocious. But I do think, again, just as you were laying out, the notion that we're only talking about him from a human rights perspective when, again, I mean, if you read the reports on Museveni, or, you know, the conduct of Rwandan forces in Congo. And particularly when you talk about interventions in Congo, you're talking about something that has really plagued the broader security picture of the continent for, you know, since 1997, in fact, when Mobutu was finally overthrown. It's stunning. I mean, and it's ludicrous. And there's nothing wrong, obviously, with going after Mugabe hard, but the notion that these guys, like a Museveni, represents anything else is just the sort of classic kind of pathetic double standard. But, you know, that sort of brief editorial out of the way, you raise an interesting
point. No, it's not true, though. It's absolutely accurate what you say.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I just cannot emphasize enough that if you read reports – And I will say I know Kagame as well, but I do happen to know a bit more about the situation in Uganda. It really would, you know, it rivals any atrocity you can imagine reading about across the globe.
Absolutely.
So I would
and
encourage
the other
people
question,
to do it.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Michael, the other question very quickly is the media's role in this.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have this silence by a major outlet like the New York Times or CNN, or the BBC, yeah, then you ask yourself, why is this uniform silence? Can it be coincidental or is it coordinated?
Mm.
And then if it's coordinated, who is it coordinated with? Because it means that if you want your policy to be, if you want your media coverage to be in alliance with a U.S. or British government policy, and it does happen, does it mean you're coordinating it with U.S. government officials and U.K. government officials? That is the question that needs to be addressed. And I think that's a serious question.
I think you're absolutely right. That's a serious question. And the final question I want to get to, because you raised this, and this is another issue that came up in President Obama's visit, just even in terms of him meeting with President Kenyatta in Kenya. And, you know, the case has dropped, but President Kenyatta was an African leader who there were questions if he had engaged in crimes against humanity. And I think those are extremely valid questions stemming from violence, I think, in 2007, I believe it was, around
Correct.
A disputed election in Kenya. Now, obviously, those charges have fallen apart and President Obama was meeting with him. You yourself pointed out earlier that if Robert Mugabe, who, again, certainly has engaged in many crimes against humanity, but if he was involved in the scale of his example, sending troops into Congo, there would be almost certainly charges against him. You know, Charles Taylor, who I think rightly was charged at The Hague with crimes against humanity. But we do see in another interesting figure who you and I have talked about, President Thabo Mbeki, who is the former president of South Africa, has talked about this a lot. The kind of Africa basically is a selective kind of selective use and test case for international law. And not, again, that these leaders don't engage in human rights abuses, but
Right.
many leaders engage in human rights abuses across the globe, and many leaders
Right.
have broken international laws, including like all of our leaders in the United States, frankly. So how
Right.
is it, you know, how is this conversation coming along now? And is President Obama meeting with Kenyatta? Is that sort of a recalibration of at least U.S. rhetoric about this? How is that kind of justice or peace issue playing out now?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought up that issue because here's the contradiction. Because now Omar al-Bashir in the Sudan, he can bring that issue now. He can say, listen, this is a bunch of games. When he visited South Africa a few weeks ago, and there's a big issue. There were stories, I think, the New York Times also wrote something, the BBC had something, blaming South Africa for failing to arrest al-Bashir, knowing that he's wanted at the ACC. Well, Bashir and South Africa and most people on the African continent know today that the issue of the ICC is basically politics. So if it's just basically politics and has nothing to do with really justice or right and wrong, why should anybody respect the ICC anymore?
Hmm.
Why should Bashir be treated any differently? And the Wall Street Journal, I don't know if we discussed this before, had a very interesting article, June 8, 2006, that the ICC had actually launched an investigation with respect to Uganda's army's alleged crimes in the Congo, and that President Museveni himself contacted then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and asked him to block that investigation.
Mm.
And according to the Wall Street Journal report, Annan told him that he didn't have the powers to do so. But it seems that something did happen because the International Court of Justice had already found Uganda liable in 2005 for the war crimes. So you'd imagine if the ICC had used the same sort of evidence, it would have actually probably indicted Museveni.
Right.
So that's the beginning when people started to really be able to confirm that the ICC is not really about justice or right and wrong, and it's just politics. So something was happened. Something happened to help Uhuru Kenyatta get off the ropes and made it possible for the president to visit Kenya. It would not have been possible for him politically. It would have just looked a bit too unsavory
right.
for the president to visit Kenya with an ICC case looming over Kenyatta.
And I mean, for what it's worth, you know, just I think it's always important in these conversations not to excuse the conduct of any African leaders, but this is nothing specific
Absolutely.
About Africa. I mean, look, you know, we're meeting with Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, who, you know, at the very, very, very most minimal case wasn't really involved in a gross negligence that led to tremendous atrocities
yes.
in Gujarat when he
yes.
governed it. And that's in the best case scenario.
Yes, I recall that.
Yeah.
In fact, I think there was U.S. policy for the U.S. ambassador not to even meet him in the past.
He wasn't allowed in the United States
before he eventually won, right?
Yeah. Yep. And now he's co-authoring op-eds with President Obama. So the world keeps moving. But Milton Alamadi, I appreciate your time always so much. I think this really gives a bigger, broader picture of what's happening in the continent. And really, again, a continent where so much is happening and this sort of old, lazy narrative of it just as sort of a, you know, a poverty case or whatever else is not only inaccurate, it just also just misses even some ways in which it's worse than that and ways in which the promise and the potential is better than most people can even conceive of because of the tremendous
Absolutely.
Human capacity there. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. And I think the young people, I think, are going to really surprise people in the next 10 years in Africa.
Let's go with that. Milton Alamadi, publisher of Black Star News. I'll talk with you soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
You might recall this story when the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson by Officer Darren Wilson brought to light this case of Henry Davis, who in 2009 was beaten up by Ferguson cops when he was handcuffed on the floor of a jail cell. And the only reason he was brought in was because during a traffic stop, the police mistook this Henry Davis for a different Henry Davis who had an outstanding warrant and brought him in for that. So that's the only reason he was even in that jail cell to begin with. And then after being in that jail cell only because of this mistaken identity and being beaten while handcuffed on the floor, the police charged him with destroying their police property because he bled on their shirts from them beating him. I mean, it sounds almost like a over-the-top black comedy skit. Like, it seems ridiculous. Well, this comes out that a federal district court ruled that Davis could not sue the cops for violating his Fourth Amendment rights because they had not injured him badly enough as he lay handcuffed on the jailhouse floor. I mean, like I just said, it sounds like it would be in some sort of black, dark comedy here. I mean, is the federal district court trying to outdo the Ferguson police in the absurdity?
Yeah, to at least paralyze a guy before you even talk about that kind of
now,
thing.
Now, this
he's
is from
handcuffed.
The Daily.
He only has a few lacerations. It's ridiculous.
Now, you know what? You're saying that in that silly, the joking, stereotypical police officer voice. But this is from the Daily Beast, and this is actually what the court ruling said when tossing out the case. Are you ready for this? As unreasonable as it may sound, this is the I'm not racist, but of federal district court rulings. As unreasonable as it may sound, a reasonable officer could have believed that being a subdued and compliant Mr. Davis, while causing only a concussion, scalp lacerations, and bruising, might I reiterate, only, with almost no permanent damage, did not violate the Constitution. Now, see, I can't tell if this federal district court is extremely stupid or if they are actually extremely tuned in to how dumb these Ferguson cops are to say, you know what, an officer like that might have thought this was reasonable.
Hey, I'm not reading the Constitution. I'm being a handcuffed black kid. You can't expect me to multitask like that. Your Honor, at long last, there has to be some fairness in the criminal justice system.
I mean,
could you imagine that? Some guy, Bruce Lee, runs him in the Constitution. Hey, Frank, stop beating the guy with the handcuffs. It violates his rights. Oh, really? I'm sorry about that, bro.
I had no idea.
I had no idea. I heard that Earth, Wind, and Fire is doing a reunion tour. You want tickets for it or something? Oh, I might be. I guess that's a little out of date. I don't know what kind of music you people like. Am I right? You want a ginger ale?
I mean,
I'm sorry about that.
I'd like to add why he was beaten up too. In the, I mean, if you don't need it, even, I mean, there is no reason to beat up someone handcuffed. Period. And then on top of that, the fact that he's handcuffed on the floor of the cell to begin with. But even more ridiculous, the reason they got angry at him, to really add up, pile on the absurdity here, was because there were no more beds in the jail cells because the Ferguson prison was so full. So he asked for a cot to put on the floor to lay down on.
Oh, Mr. High and Mighty wants a freaking cot.
That's why they beat him up.
Hey, dude, I understand. It pisses me off that this little fuck would have the temerity to ask for a cot, too. But I just read the Constitution, and we can't beat him while he's in handcuffs, all right? It's against the law. Oh, look at the brains on Tony all the time, reminding people of the Constitution. What a freaking genius.
Now, I would
you have waited 5 minutes? I could at least get a couple of, as you would call them, lacerations in.
Only lacerations, remember. Only. And we didn't injure him badly enough. There's almost no permanent damage, almost. But, you know, there's
Look at 50 Cent. He speaks with a slur. Didn't do him any bad in his career.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I mean, there's a bright side here. Davis appealed. And the appeals court ruled in his favor.
Great.
And this opens up the fact that with this reverse of decision, Davis could now go ahead with his excessive force suit. And because after this ridiculousness, we need even more of a light at the end of the tunnel. One of the cops who beat up Davis and left him with almost no permanent damage actually retired and went on to become a city council member in the First Ward. And when this case came to light, the cop ended up not seeking a second term, which led to Ella Jones, a black woman, to win the seat, which made the city council a 3-on-3 race-wise.
So maybe there is some justice in the world. He wins the appeal. The guy loses his seat. They should both be in jail. But I guess there's some good in that story.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. We're going to move to the fun half. That was great. I'm a big fan of Milton. I hope everybody enjoyed that. On the fun half, we got many stories for you. But most importantly, we have your IMs. Potentially, most importantly, we have your phone calls. Where you can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'm going to call into the phones right now. What else can we say? Write us a review on iTunes. That is a great way to support the show. We don't exactly know. What is it, Matt? 646-257-3920?
That is the number.
646-257-3920. We don't exactly know how all the algorithms work on iTunes, but we do know that when you write us a review, that helps a lot.
The call is now first in line.
Take me down. All right, boom. So also, you can become a member of the Majority Report today. You know the deal. It's less than a cup of coffee today. It makes you the boss of us. And not some big company or even foundation for that matter. That's why we can be so independent. That's why we can have a deep dive with Milton Alamadi. And why we could probably deliver you some incredibly puerile and immature humor in the second half. It's why we can take a deep dive on the ANC. And then I can do an impersonation of Nelson Mandela, which frankly maybe is questionable. but hopefully does not desecrate that incredible hero's memory. We're able to do all of these things because you deliver for us. Thank you so much. Follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. Like us on Facebook. We're sharing a lot of videos. Noah, why don't you come on over? Sit, get close to a mic, dude. So yeah, all of that stuff is great. Download the app. We are going to go to the fun half right now, and I'm going to take your call. I see a call waiting, so just let us play some of this horrible La Poupée song, and then we'll take your call. We'll be right back in the fun half.
Hey.